wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. Today in our program, Jan Hocken interviews Diana Meisenhelter and Brandon Zero, activists with Extinction Rebellion Portland, about the city's climate action plans. Immediately following that, Jan is back. This time, Jan interviews Sophie Smith, an immigration activist living and working in the border city of Arivaca, Arizona. They'll be discussing the case of Scott Warren, arrested and charged with giving humanitarian aid to two Honduran refugees. But now Bill Riznick leads off with a second part of an interview with Judge Lynn Alderman of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, who wrote an article about to appear in the Journal of the Very Liberal American Constitution Society, titled The Roberts Court Assault on Democracy. Bill?
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Riznick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Judge Lynn Alderman of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. He's written an article, The Roberts Court, Assault on Democracy. We've discussed so far their decisions on voting rights, talking about their approval of gerrymandering, of purges of voters that hit black and liberal voters the hardest, as well as the destruction of the Voting Rights Act that called for a pre-clearance of any voting rights law in areas that had historically discriminated. And once they got rid of that law, saying it was a relic of the past, Texas and many other places, as Judge Adelman discussed, they immediately reinstated laws that were discriminatory. Tell us about how do you approach that issue?
Well, in writing about democracy, I thought it was important not only to talk about voting rights. The voting rights is obviously a fundamental to democracy, but it's And as I've talked about some of the court's decisions in that area already, and there's more. There's a recent decision in which the court washed its hands of partisan gerrymandering, which really dilutes the effect of people's votes. It allows state legislatures to gerrymander legislatures in favor of one party, and people who are not of that party, then their votes are pretty much made worthless. But there's also another part of it, of the decisions of the court, that I wanted to talk about, and those had to do with wealth and inequality, because we're all aware of the increasing inequality in the United States and the changes that have occurred since maybe the 1950s and 60s, when when unions were much stronger and there was a much larger and more well-paid sort of working class and middle class. And as unions have become less powerful, and as a fairly small number of people, sometimes called the 1%, have become very, very wealthy, our society has become much more stratified and much more unequal, and everyone is aware of this. And highly unequal societies have really serious problems just by the fact that there's such a huge gap between rich and poor. I mean, there's no doubt that political power follows economic power, and when you have a small number of people that are very powerful economically, they also have very great political power. And this is people talk about oligarchy, and that's sort of one of the characteristics of an oligarchy. And they also, highly unequal societies have slower economic growth than equal societies or more equal societies. Huge economic inequality creates all kinds of problems: health problems, lower life expectancies, higher infant mortality rates, higher rates of mental illness. Inequality is associated with all kinds of social problems, including lower rates of trust, lower social cohesion, and higher rates of violent crime. So My interest in this part of the story was to ask if the Roberts Court was doing anything to perhaps counteract some of the trends that we see in our political economy. And I noted that in the 50s and 60s, the Warren Court did play a kind of a very positive role in dealing with some of our problems of, that are sort of similar. For example, the Warren Court addressed the problem of racial segregation, which was inconsistent with democracy, and it addressed the problem of reapportionment, which was also really antithetical to democracy. It addressed some of the problems of a very unfair criminal justice system. And so I think it would be desirable for the present Supreme Court to do something analogous. But in fact, what I think it's been doing is sort of reinforcing the economic and political inequality that we see going on just by virtue of the way the economy works. Probably the best example of that is the campaign finance decisions, which really the First Amendment has been kind of interpreted in such a way that people with wealth can virtually give all kinds of contributions, and that's held by the court to be their free speech right, where almost any attempt by a democratically elected legislature to put limits on campaign contributions or independent expenditures or to provide sort of public financing efforts in order to try to equal the playing field, all those kinds of initiatives by legislatures have been questioned by the Supreme Court because of their very narrow interpretation of the First Amendment.
Yeah, they've also strengthened corporate power a whole lot. You mentioned the decisions that undermine unions, decisions that make it more and more difficult for people to band together in class actions, decisions that, and these are all reversals, actually, of prior precedent that have been found to be perfectly constitutional. And they also approved arbitration agreements, which force employees to get a job. You have to sign an agreement that if you have any grievances against the company, it goes to arbitration rather than to the courts. And, of course, the arbitration system is a lot quicker, cheaper, and also the companies have a big role in choosing the judges and influencing the judges. Not to say that they don't have a big role in influencing other judges as well, but all of those things work against sort of ordinary people being able to having the capacity to actually challenge. Give us an example of one of those where they're, how the court has dealt with it.
Well, I guess one of the more obvious ones is this is the famous Citizens United case, which was a campaign finance case, which basically extended to corporations the power to spend money on campaigns. And really, that, you know, that's in, spending money on campaigns is not really part of why corporations exist. And that decision has sort of justly achieved a great deal of notoriety and opposition. Another example might be this sort of little-known Sorrell case in Vermont. The case, I guess, is called Sorrell versus IMS Healthcare, and involved a Vermont statute which prohibited pharmacies from selling data regarding prescriptions without affirmative consent from the prescribing physicians. The idea was a couple things. One, to protect the privacy of physicians so that they weren't bombarded by drug companies trying to get them to promote their particular product. And also it had to do with privacy. It was a right to privacy issue. And also an effort to reduce the cost of health care by curbing disproportionate sale of expensive drugs. So this law was a totally legitimate attempt by the legislature to accomplish some socially beneficial purposes. The law exempted academic researchers and nonprofits because they did not pose the same problem as representatives from the pharmaceutical industry. And then the court in another 5-4 decision struck this down, saying This distinction was not a rational response to a marketplace structured by forces that give profit-seeking actors particular incentives, but it was legislative interference with the marketplace. You know, in the view of the Roberts Court, the marketplace is by definition a kind of a benign space. And the Vermont legislature, again, a democratically elected body, was sort of interfering with the market by discriminating against particular speakers who were pharmaceutical marketers. So, I mean, it just, first of all, it's an amazing use of the First Amendment. And then they did that in the, one of the cases you mentioned, the case about, it's called Janus, and that's the case that had to do with public employee unions being able to charge what they call agency fees to people who were not members of the union but who benefited from the collective bargaining agreements that, that were negotiated by the union. And the, as you said, that had been on the books, had been approved by the Supreme Court 40 years ago. Well, another 5-4 decision, they struck that down. And then you also mentioned an arbitration case, and there, you know, they upheld the power of a company to basically say that a new employee had to agree to not be part of a class action challenging any kind of wages or conditions of employment, and that those had to go to arbitration if that's what the agreement said. All these decisions basically make it harder for working people, and they sort of reinforce this economic inequality that I talked about earlier. So instead of kind of intervening in a more positive way to kind of offset the trends toward the anti-democratic trends toward economic inequality, the court here is, and in other cases, is reinforcing it. The same is true with the way they treat poor people. This well, there's the famous Obamacare case in which the court upheld the Affordable Care Act, at least part of it, the more famous part of it. But there was a part of it that the court struck down. See, Congress wanted to provide health care to as many people as possible. And so the way they dealt with poor people was that they expanded Medicaid. And Medicaid is a... it's a federal program, but it's administered by the states. And basically, the, in the expansion of Medicaid statute in the Affordable Care Act, Congress agreed to pay for the, I think, 90% or 100% for the first 3 years and 90% thereafter, something like that. It was clear that Congress was footing the bill for virtually the entire cost of the service. And the Roberts Court, this is now by 7-2. This was not only a 5-4 vote, and that's also disturbing for other reasons. But anyway, they struck that down, saying that it violated the spending clause of the U.S. Constitution because it coerced states into participating in this program that the court distinguished from previous Medicaid programs. So the effect of that now has been that many, many people, I mean, I think there's still some 17 or 18 states that have, including Wisconsin, where I live, that have refused to participate in the expanded program. So the poor people in those states, and most of the states are in the old Confederacy, so there's a large number of African Americans who are disadvantaged by a state's refusal to participate in this program. And so that's what's happened, is that if they had upheld that, if they had left that alone, that law alone that Congress passed, then all these poor people would have health insurance. But now millions don't have it because they said that Congress couldn't tell the states to do this. And there's a large number of African Americans that are disadvantaged, and it's had a huge effect on people's health. In some of the states where there's still a fairly large number of deaths from AIDS, almost all of those deaths could have been prevented had there been Medicaid available to those victims. So I just think it seems this is another way in which the court is really reinforcing economic and political trends that are harmful, rather than stepping in and trying to reinforce more democratic kinds of approaches.
You know, one, there was another case that it seems to me deserves attention. It was shocking to me reading your article. The case that came again out of Texas.
Oh, you're talking about the San Antonio School District case?
Yeah, that was where state aid to rich districts is like $1,000 per student, and state aid to poor districts is like $370 per student. And the, what was it, legislation that in fact forced the state of Texas to equalize the amount of money given per student, and that was struck down by, this was the Burger Court apparently, not the Roberts Court, but the Roberts Court and the Rehnquist Courts, none of them ever touched that. It's a shocking decision.
Yeah, it was San Antonio versus San Antonio Independent School District versus Rodriguez. This goes back to 1973, and it sort of presaged some of these Roberts Court decisions that I've been talking about. It was a 5-4 decision, again, the conservative majority, and they upheld a school financing system in Texas in which for every $1,000 that the state sent wealthy districts, it sent only $370 to poor districts. And the court basically said that students in public schools had no constitutional right to an equal public education. And there was an eloquent dissent by the great Justice Thurgood Marshall, who receives much less recognition than he's entitled to. He argued that the government had to treat all citizens equally, and he questioned how the judiciary in a democracy that was supposedly committed to equality could uphold this system. He noted that the discriminatory expenditures at issue seriously impaired the ability of the poor to participate effectively in society, because there's obviously a close connection between education and political participation, which is the heart of citizenship. So this was a long time ago, but I think it's important to note that since the Warren Court ended, which was I think in 1970 or right around there, we've had now 50 years of courts dominated by conservatives, and the San Antonio School District case really was a kind of a marker, and that basically commenced a tradition that's been going on for 50 years of many cases in which economic inequality is not supported by the court.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here talking to Judge Lynn Edelman of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, who's written an article, The Roberts Court Assault on Democracy, which also talks about the whole conservative, starting with the Burger Court, the Rehnquist Court, now the Roberts Court, increasingly radical conservative decisions supporting corporate and rich people's power and undermining the both voting rights and the kind of equality and creating precariousness among the poor that undermine their capacity to actually participate in making any kind of decision that might offend their corporate powers. Judge Edelman, what's your sense of how the court could be somehow changed towards interpreting the constitutions in ways that create equality and provide for the kind of life experiences and income and possibilities that make for the popular classes to be able to really participate in the conditions of their life and not be dominated by their economic needs? And the question, of course, is how do we change the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I think the only thing that we can do really is to try to build a lot of popular support for more progressive positions. I think that would do a couple things. One, if we elected presidents who had different views of how these issues should be resolved. That would lead to different kind of judicial appointments. But also, I do think that the courts pay attention to public opinion, and I think the courts do not want to be seen as outliers, as completely opposing progress. I mean, I think that the New Deal showed that. There's that famous saying about one of the justices who had previously been quite negative on some of the Roosevelt New Deal initiatives changed his views, and that led to the saying a switch in time saved nine, the idea that protected the court. I just think that the courts are mindful of how public feels, and I think Chief Justice Roberts is very interested in having the court not be perceived as overly political. So if there's a very strong feelings on the public, I think that would have an effect.
Judge Lynn Edelman, thanks so much for talking to us today.
It's been a pleasure, Bill. Appreciate your inviting me.
Keep up the good work.
Sail on, sail on, oh my dear ship of state, to the shores of need, past the reefs of greed, through the swamps of hate. Sail on, sail on. It's coming to America first, the cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery for change, and it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family's broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA.
This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. The song was Democracy by Leonard Cohen. Though a little ambiguous, the lyrics are ominous and don't appear to portend well for the democracy that's coming to the USA. Now Jan Hocken interviews Diana Meisenhelter and Brandon Zero with Extinction Rebellion Portland, also known as XR. Diana Meisenhelter has worked 20 years for an anti-poverty agency embedded in public schools, and prior to that did union organizing and was founder and director of Saving Community Development. Brandon Zero is an activist and journalist who joined the Extinction Rebellion early this year. His work has appeared on CNBC, BBC, Acruis, Deal Reporter, Bloomberg, and the Financial Times. They'll be talking about why city policy is inadequate and why XR is demanding annual concrete action plans towards decarbonization and net zero 2025. They'll also talk about an upcoming December 12th event. Jan?
Well, Brandon Zero and Diana Meisenhelter, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
We'll be taking the temperature on the city's climate action plan and discussing an event organized by Extinction Rebellion, Portland chapter, XR PDX, and what we're invited to do to participate this Thursday. Brandon, let's start with Extinction Rebellion, more commonly known as XR, and what brings this emerging and burgeoning group in the climate justice movement together, and then perhaps talk about a few of the demands that will be taken into the event this Thursday.
Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent disobedience in an attempt to halt mass extinction and minimize the risk of social collapse. We have three demands: that governments declare a climate emergency, act to get emissions to net zero by 2025, and empower citizens to make our own decisions about climate change. Our tactics help set us apart. We use momentum-driven organizing to try to activate 3.5% of Portland's population to achieve system change. And that's because academics studying the most effective movements have shown that nonviolent acts of civil disobedience are more effective than violent movements, and that no government can resist the demands of 3.5% of citizens. The group began in the UK last year and went international in April.
And I think some of the question of tactics, which we can return to in another show, of direct action and what that encompasses, civil disobedience or different forms of it and different consequences in different jurisdictions legally in this country. But I think part of this tactic, as I understand it, is to move beyond kind of the legislative petitioning, going through the system and demanding politicians to do their job and being more forcefully taking power in our own hands, so to speak. And perhaps you can address that. The demand, one demand, it relates to the concept of a citizens' assembly. Mm-hmm. And can you say a little bit about that and the demand for a just transition? And then we'll talk about perhaps how to carry those principles into practice this week.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, there are other environmental groups that already advocate for legislative or other forms of political change. We take the view that civil disobedience is a really good way to bring more eyeballs to a situation and actually mobilize people for critical change. The demand that you speak about to have people more involved in citizen assemblies, I think, is really important because XR believes that in the process of advocating for climate change, we also have to give a larger share of a voice, not just to elected officials, not just to representatives, but to ordinary people in frontline communities, to disenfranchise peoples whose voices maybe haven't been heard in this thus far. And give them a voice so that people who actually live in an environment or in a neighborhood that might be affected by climate change can directly tell the community, tell people in power, this is how it affects me. These are the solutions that I would like to see in the community.
So, Diana, tell us what's happening this Thursday and how these XR principles are carried into practice. First, let's talk about the city's climate action plan and how to assess what's happening with the city on that front.
So we submitted demands in September that the city make a plan for reaching net zero by 2025 with concrete action steps presented each December for the following year. And on Thursday, the city will be listening to reports from utilities about insufficient progress towards the city and county's 100% renewable goals at 3 p.m. in council chambers. The city's climate action plan calls for too little too late, and despite city goals of 100% renewable electricity by 2035, Pacific Corps has intentions to keep half their Oregon coal plants and PGE planning to do only 40% carbon-free by that date. So both are totally unacceptable given what scientists are telling us about the climate crisis. And they also make clear the utilities do their strategy of tailoring their approaches to the markets, which means they might, through voluntary consumer purchase programs, get closer to renewable energy goals for electricity in Multnomah County, but they will continue business as usual in most of the region, further contributing to climate disaster. So every new scientific response paints a more dire picture, and pushing for annual steps and net zero this decade is a reasonable response, since we don't know yet the impact of multiple feedback loops in the albedo effect. Without clear steps, the rapid managed decline of fossil fuels is unlikely to move forward. Even a checklist with clear concrete action steps would be better, because the latest IPCC report stated that global decarbonization of at least 8% annually needs to happen to avoid the worst effects of climate catastrophe, and more given here in the United States, since we're second only to China in emissions. If Portland can't reach the net zero within the IPCC timeline here, who the heck will? We need concrete annual steps to get there.
So, Brandon, perhaps you can weigh in on this point that it's not just, I mean, one issue is the speed of moving to renewables and other key benchmarks. But I think what you're suggesting, Diana, is that the institutions and the corporate structure that govern the energy system in this state and elsewhere have to respond to the political will of the people, but there are all kinds of mechanisms for undermining and greenwashing and appearing to do more than they're doing. How do you look at this issue from an XR perspective, that it's not just about pushing up the timetable, making these changes to renewable by 2025 instead of 2035 or 2050, but also how they're brought about, you're saying, is important.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't want to de-emphasize the timeline. It is still very important that Portland and the entire world decarbonize, move to decarbonize by 2025. But you're entirely right. One of the approaches that XR takes is to look at whether the utilities are actually changing their energy mix in real time. And what we've seen is, despite the fact that cities like Eugene, like Seattle, like Tacoma, are run almost entirely on renewables, that Portland still uses something like 66-67%, Multnomah County still generates 67% of its energy from fossil fuel related sources.
Including coal, right?
Including coal, that's natural gas. And, you know, despite all of our grandest ambitions for carbon capture technology, that simply isn't being used at scale. So if we look at the attempts that we need to make, the concrete steps that we need to make to decarbonize, we see that utilities are using cash that they generate from those fossil fuel, selling those fossil fuels, to purchase energy credits instead of closing the plants that are the source of the problem. So that's what we mean when we say take concrete steps. We want to actually take action so that plants can decarbonize now.
So what would be happening at the City Hall? Can you say more about what's happening at the City Hall this Thursday? Do either of you want to also talk about whether the Portland Clean Energy Fund, the ballot measure that was passed as, I think, a progressive measure last November, is part of the assessment? And do we want to also recognize progress where it's made?
Yes, the city has done some good things. The people passed this ballot measure, and Portland is starting to implement it, hopefully this year. And this is an example of U.S.'s fourth demand, or the USXR's fourth demand, which is a just transition to an equitable society.
And that is part of that. Was that part of that proposal?
No, but what I'm saying is the Clean Energy Fund is a very good example. Local groups like Verde, who is working to employ people of color, frontline communities, to do solar and other clean energies and do weatherization and all of the kinds of things we want to be seeing, as well as community-based and owned production of energy. All of those kinds of things are being talked about and hopefully implemented through the Clean Energy Fund, which the city's also defending from attack. The city's done some positive things in terms of doing a risk bond study on trying to have companies that are fossil fuel companies take responsibility if there's disasters, because that's been happening more and more, as well as denying Zenith a permit that will go under Front Avenue. However, there are...
You mean, can you just say a bit about what Zenith is in reference to Front Avenue?
Yeah, Zenith brings tar sands oil from Bakken, which is one of the worst polluting oils, and tries to export it to Asia and other markets. And the city has a no fossil fuel infrastructure except for regional markets policy that they just it was challenged in the courts, and they just made the tweaks necessary to put it back on the books, which is a step in the right direction. However, if we're not focusing on decarbonization, going down every year with concrete steps to get us to net zero, we're really missing the boat, and it won't affect the things. And that's why we're having a rally this Thursday, and I'm going to turn it over to Brandon to talk about
that.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're taking our message to City Hall directly on Thursday, and anyone is welcome to join. Come to the City Council meeting and judge for yourself whether Portland is making sufficient progress towards its own goals. So on Thursday at 2 p.m., Extinction Rebellion will sit in on reports from Portland utilities on their progress for shifting towards renewables. We'll sit in silent protest as we hear how companies that rely on our power, that we rely on for our power, explain why Multnomah County still sources 67% of its power from coal and natural gas. So come on out. We'll be wearing red and sitting in silent protest due to City Hall rules. And then join us at 4 p.m. outside of City Hall as we demand concrete actions that the city take in 2020, next year, to move Portland towards net zero emissions by 2025.
So can you say more about the Winter Uprising? I like the tone of that. XR is known for a certain style in street theater, a theatrical style that is about, I think, movements that are successful, also creating pleasure and joy and a kind of celebratory tone as they confront very daunting problems. And I think XR kind of really, really expresses that dynamic in successful movements between joy and anger and despair.
Yeah, I mean, we do have, as you mentioned, at some of our protests, we have people called the Red Rebels who will sort of facilitate a mourning process that we all are undergoing as our planet endures climate change in ways that will leave our society, our environment irreparably changed. At the same time, we do also elevate our voices. We've had sing-alongs at other protests, carols. We've, obviously had people in megaphones to give speeches. It's a dynamic event, these protests, that usually sort of try to bring in both anger, education, and a sense of mourning for the magnanimity of the situation.
Mm-hmm. As well as kind of joy and the possibilities of a transformed world, or anticipating a different way of thinking about pleasure and joy beyond kind of commodity culture that capitalism creates.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is one of the core values of XR. And if people want to participate in a way that means that they can't come out today, on Thursday, that's fine. The next best thing to do is to call the mayor's office and register your voice that way. And the next best way is to go to our website, xrpdx.org, sign up for our newsletter, and that way you can join future actions to join us in the street.
Because there's a lot coming down the street.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, just in closing, maybe say again where to meet, and that this is a response to an action in response to the city's climate action plan being presented at City Hall this Thursday, and listeners are encouraged to come and join the action at City Hall, sitting silently in protest inside the city chambers of City Hall. What's the address there?
Yeah, that's 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue. Kicks off at 2 p.m.
And then if you can't meet that or can stay longer for the Winter Uprising, that'll be outside City Hall.
Yes.
From 4 to 6. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Brandon Zero and Diana Meisenhelter. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Here too at KBOO.
Thanks.
In the year 95-95, I'm kind of wondering if man is going to be alive. He's taken everything this old earth can give, and he ain't put back nothing, whoa, whoa. Now it's been 10,000 years, man has cried a billion tears for what he never knew. Now man's reign is through, but through eternal night, the twinkling of starlight, so very far away, maybe it's only yesterday. In the year 2525,
this is the OMO Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Zager and Evans with their 1968 hit In the Year 2525, the prophetic but hopefully false prophecy about humanity's future. John Hawken is back now talking with Sophie Smith on the criminal charges against Scott Warren. Sophie Smith is a longtime humanitarian community organizer and writer living in the militarized zone of the U.S. borderlands. Scott Warren was charged with the dastardly crime of giving two young men from Central America food, water, and a place to sleep over the course of 3 days. At a second trial in Arizona, he was acquitted by the jury.
Welcome again to KBOO, Sophie Smith.
Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, for those of you who provide humanitarian aid in the borderlands, as well as human rights supporters everywhere, Scott Warren's acquittal last month is truly something to celebrate. It's a moral victory. Can you give us a a look back on that now and a bit of a summary on how the charges against him came about. There was a first trial earlier this year in June, I believe, and then the one last month where he was acquitted. Give us a little background on the case.
Sure. So Scott Warren is a resident of Ajo, Arizona, which is a small rural town about 40 miles north of the line with Mexico in southern Arizona. And he's also a volunteer with a number of humanitarian organizations in the area. And there's been organized humanitarian aid for nearly two decades now in southern Arizona in the desert, because Border Patrol policy has focused around concentrating enforcement infrastructure like border walls, personnel, surveillance technology in and around urban areas and ports of entry in the border in order to deflect people attempting to enter the U.S. without official permission into remote deserts. And as a consequence, over the last two decades, the remains of over 8,000 people have been recovered from remote areas on U.S. soil in southern Arizona and South Texas and elsewhere. And many more people have perished in the wilderness and have never been found. So since this policy was initiated in 1994, rural residents in small towns like Ajo have been providing direct care to people coming through the mountains, coming through the deserts, to become lost, injured, left behind, and go to people's homes or to these small hamlets looking for help. And then the last maybe decade or so, there's been an organized humanitarian presence in these areas, both where I live in a small town called Aravaca and also where Scott lives in a town called Ajo. So this is sort of the context in which he was volunteering with a humanitarian group in January of 2018, so nearly 2 years ago, and encountered two people at a humanitarian aid station in Ajo, and Jose and Christian, and provided them food, water, beds, and blankets, according to the criminal complaint against him. Also provided them access to medical care with a local nurse. Jose had an injured rib. They had both been out in the wilderness and lost for several days without access to clean drinking water. And after 3 days, there was a coordinated Border Patrol raid on the aid station in which both Christian and Jose were arrested, and Scott was also arrested. Christian and Jose were actually granted immunity in exchange for becoming government witnesses, which meant that they provided some witness testimony for the government. And Scott was initially charged with two counts of felony harboring, one for each person, and also a conspiracy charge the first time around.
Just to stop at that point a moment, because given the universal recognition of the right to provide and indeed the moral duty to provide humanitarian aid, and this is built into international law, what was that border the prosecutors were working with, that the boundary between provision of humanitarian aid and these harboring and conspiracy charges? Because that was at issue in the first trial, and then harboring, as I understand, was the criminal charge in the second one. Can you just explain what the prosecutor's case was? Because on the face of it, it seems absurd.
Sure. Yeah, and I think the case has to be viewed in historical context of what was happening in 2017, 2018. Politically, which is the Bush administration comes online and purges district U.S. attorney offices.
You mean Trump?
The country.
Trump?
Sorry, the Trump administration.
Bush, Trump.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
No, that's okay. I think most people knew who you meant.
Yes, that's so funny. The Trump administration comes online and purges U.S. attorney's offices, and Jeff Sessions makes a speech saying that they're going to start prosecuting people for these crimes, or what they consider the crime of assisting anyone without documentation in the United States. So this is part of a national movement to really criminalize people without papers and anyone who provides them any measure of support. And so it really represented a massive widening of the scope of what a harboring prosecution might look like, or conspiracy prosecution, which we've really seen most often leveled against people involved in like business in exchange of money, for moving people northward and things like this. But the government's case the first time around, the first trial of Scott was in June and ended in a hung jury. It was in federal court in Tucson. But the government's case was revealed to really revolve around the fact that Scott was present at the aid station for 3 days, offered them beds to sleep in indoors in a shelter, and that he was seen by Border Patrol agents standing outside of the aid station with Jose and Christian pointing to area landmarks.
And that was that was what they built their case around, right?
Yes. The government argued that Scott was directing Christian and Jose by pointing at area landmarks how to circumvent a nearby Border Patrol checkpoint in order to make their way northward. That was the government's claim.
But then the defense had to argue against that, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it really broke open sort of what the nature of humanitarian aid is, which is material resources like food, water, shelter, medical care, but also the providing of information to people, particularly geographic orientation. What the government didn't want to mention was the area to the north of that aid station is active U.S. Air Force bombing range. And there is a single paved road for, I think, 40 miles to the east and 100 miles to the west in that area. And so what Scott was doing was describing how to access help, describing area risks so that Christian and Jose could make their own decisions and evaluate what kind of danger they might be in and be prepared if that's the journey that they chose to undertake. So I think the case was really interesting because it got into the way in which the role of humanitarian intervention is certainly not to make someone's plans or decision, life decisions for them, but to provide them with basic resources and information to make safer decisions for themselves and to know how to access rescue if they find.
And that was at the center of the defense strategy or arguments for the second trial where he was acquitted, because it seems to me that's a really important point, that mm-hmm. it was not just defending the most minimal standard of decency in humanitarian aid, but challenging the prosecution case that anything beyond the most basic material support represented harboring in the case of the second trial.
Right. Yeah, I think that it was an important widening of the scope of what humanitarian intervention needs to look like in a corridor in which the deaths that are largely occurring because people are disoriented in a foreign landscape and too far from help to access rescue. And the government strategy of enforcing the border by making it more dangerous is only reinforced by a prosecution that's based around making it illegal to tell someone where they are and how to get to a highway to access help. So it really revealed kind of the nature of state violence, I think, in the border zone, which is about the deprivation not only of people of water and food, but access to rescue or even knowledge as to where they are. And so what it became was ultimately a precedent-setting case within the district here, and really the first ruling on the nature of food, water, medical aid, shelter, and orientation as human rights that we all have. So what became a real threat to criminalizing humanitarian intervention by both border residents and organized groups really produced a tool and a level of understanding and protection for those of us participating in the work daily.
There's a way in which precedent means something in the legal, technical sense, what can be cited as mm-hmm. In building a case, but there's also precedent in this larger, more political, discursive sense of how you argue for things. Could you say a bit about how you think about the acquittal as precedent setting?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a lawyer.
We say a lot in this show, those of us about the law who are not lawyers, but go ahead, share what you know.
What I really mean is that there hasn't been even a legal case. Laws around transporting, harboring, smuggling, there really haven't been federal court cases that have provided a ruling around humanitarian aid and the distinction between those crime.
And this, but so this was in a federal court. Was that significant in terms of the precedent? Can you? How so?
So this is federal court. This is in the district in southern Arizona. So within the district, it does provide legal precedent that it can be cited in other criminal prosecutions. It can't carry in this way in South Texas or something like that. But it's really significant in southern Arizona because the district that this has occurred in, it plays host to at least half of the border deaths nationally. So it really does provide really clear indication to those of us living and working on the ground that food, water, beds, and blankets are humanitarian aid, are not criminal. And I think it's been really empowering already to see the effect in terms of local organizing, educating residents about their rights with Border Patrol, their rights to provide humanitarian aid, that we can cite this ruling. In addition to, I think, a really critical piece in the second trial, the second go-around, which resulted in the acquittal a few weeks ago, was that it included a jury instruction in which the court said from the very outset that that there's no obligation, there's no affirmative obligation among people in this country to report on others that they believe to be in the country without authorization.
That's significant.
It's really significant. And
because whatever
failure to report does not constitute evasion, an evasion crime or concealment or any of the pieces that you would need to build a harboring case.
It's part of the chilling effect of the ruthlessness of the Justice Department and the legal apparatus of the Trump administration is that people often think all their rights are gone, or there's there's a panic around these things. And to be able to say to people, no, you do have the right. It's been recognized by the courts to provide aid without reporting people, that's significant.
Yeah, and I think it's important in this context. You know, it's really the purpose of the political trial, which is an interesting form, right? Like, there's certain people who have access to stand political trial to challenge their charges, to not take a plea deal, and who can galvanize the kind of support to have a great trial lawyer like Scott did to win a case like this to provide protection for others. And we know that Scott, who is, he's a PhD, he's in his 30s, he has no criminal history, he's been, you know, having good community standing for years, and the system is predisposed to serve him justice within the court.
He's kind of a model plaintiff
in this way, right? And we see that we see that, you know, folks who might have a criminal record, people of color coming from impacted communities could, you know, are treated really differently by the justice system. So I think it's important to look at, you know, the way in which we can leverage our privilege strategically to try to produce movement tools that can really serve all of us. And Scott was in a position to win this case on behalf of all of us. So that's, you know, that's really the deeper victory, I think.
Yeah, and tell us in closing where people, our listeners, can continue to follow the work there that you're doing and the humanitarian aid and political work in the borderlands.
Sure. Well, there's been some great reporting on The Intercept, so you should look at Ryan Devereaux's articles. You can donate to the direct humanitarian work that's happening in borderlands communities. You can go to www.phparavaca.org.
That stands for People Helping People, an organization you're working with.
We support rural residents providing humanitarian aid. You can also go to the Ajo Samaritans Facebook group to donate to that organization. And keep an eye out for reporting on resistance to the border wall in Oregon Pipe National Monument in southern Arizona. There's a growing coalition that is decrying the building of new border wall.
Yeah, and we look forward to
sacred site.
We look forward to hearing further reporting on that. Thank you so much, Sophie Smith, for being with us
on
the Olmo Variety Hour this morning, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Olmo Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Thank you to all today's participants, Bill Resnick and Judge Adelman on the dangers of the Roberts Court, to Jan Hocken and guest Diana Meissenhilder and Brandon Zero on Portland's Climate Action Plan, and to Jan Hocken and Sophie Smith for their report on the Scott Warren case. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives to move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. This is KBOO Portland. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety at Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one word, no caps, at gmail.com.